Hello, all. Welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Dracona's Books. Kai Dracona's Books is an independent anarchist press dedicated to publishing socially engaged literature. With me, as always, are the two other editors of Kai Dracona's Books, Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger. And today we are going to discuss a really quite interesting work of literature called Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi. At least that was how the narrator of the audiobook I listened to pronounced it, Varanasi. He was English, so I don't know if that's how an American would pronounce it. But yeah, super, super interesting work. Not sure what to call it exactly, and I don't know if that's a question that interests either of you. If it is, we can talk about it. If not, cool. Otherwise, I'm gonna let Hans, since it was his pick, you know, just give us a little deeper introduction into the book, so we can talk about it.
Yeah. So, you know, I had, like a lot of things that I pick for this podcast, when I chose it initially, as much as anything, I was interested in bringing it to you guys and saying, what does this mean? What's this trying to say? What's this about? And I actually felt on a reread, like maybe I understood it reasonably well. So what I might do is talk about, to some extent, combine my interpretation of it with a brief synopsis and overview, and then you guys can tell me if that sits right with you. So you mentioned, Patrick, that you weren't sure what to call it. I read an interview with Jeff Dyer where he somewhat jokingly suggested calling it a diptych, by which he was referring to, there's a two-part structure here where the first half of the book is narrated in third person. It describes a journalist named Jeff in the city of Venice, who's there for the Biennale and has an affair and goes to a lot of parties. And then the second half of the book is narrated in first person, but it most likely is the same character. And this time he is in the Indian city of Varanasi and goes there to write an article and then either becomes enlightened or disintegrates or both over the course of his time there. And there's not any, for the most part, and we can talk about links between the two parts later on, right? But in terms of plot details, there's very little linkage between the two. The narrator in the second half doesn't refer to Laura, who is the romantic or sexual interest in the Venice section of the book. And I think for a lot of readers, much of the interest that drives the reading of the first half is the question of the narrator's relationship to this woman, Laura, that he meets and has very strong, certainly very strong sexual feelings for, maybe very strong romantic feelings for, that he has this very strong attraction to. At the end of the section, they part, leaving open the idea that they might meet again in the future, but not making it clear when they will. And so there's the question of the future of their relationship is left unaddressed at the end of the first half of the book, and then she is not mentioned again in the second half. Though, you know, by implication, you can maybe put together that they didn't, in fact, see each other again. But if you read the first half of the book if you read the first half of the book hoping to have conventional resolution of the plot in the second half, then you're going to be disappointed. But what, having reread the book with that understanding, it seems to me to be much more about desire and then the parting with desire, right? The one thing that stuck with me reading the first half especially is that Jeff is thinking constantly about wanting. He's thinking constantly about wanting and the paradoxes of wanting and then trying to come to terms with either the continued fact of wanting or how to deal with how to deal with the understanding that if you want and then you get, the wanting often doesn't go away, right? And I don't know that I have any particular passages highlighted that I can quote, but the words desire and want come up over and over and over again throughout that section. And if you read it thinking about that concept and looking for it, it really becomes apparent how much the first half of the book is about wanting and all the little kinds of wants and desires that people have, particularly people who are maybe more interested in sex and parties and drugs, right? I think it's particularly apt that he does a lot of cocaine, frankly, in the first half of the book, right? Because cocaine is the cycle of want and gratification and then the resurgence of wanting compressed to its most elemental form, right? You want cocaine, you get cocaine, you have 30 seconds of, and then you really want more cocaine. And you basically just go through that cycle until you either run out of cocaine and don't know where to get more, or run out of money, or something happens that jars you out of it, right? But in some sense, the character in the first half has spent his whole life in a version of that cycle. There's very little that he actually cares about or is interested in or is engaged with beyond that cycle of desire, temporary gratification, resurgence of desire, right? And then in the second half of the book, something happens, and we can maybe debate what, we can talk about what, but something happens where the cycle of wanting, it stops, it fades, it's broken. And he becomes, and again, this is maybe another thing we can talk about, he becomes either enlightened or crazy or both, and either achieves peace or disintegrates, right? Achieves either peace or madness or both. So that's my understanding essentially of what the book is about, right? The first half of the book is about trying to achieve transcendence through pleasure. And then the second half of the book is about achieving transcendence through renunciation. And in maybe it's debatable how much success there is or how desirable either of those models might be, right? I know that, I mean, like most people, I had my, you know, drugs and partying and had my phase in my 20s of drugs and in early 30s and mid 30s of drugs and partying and, you know, chasing immediate sexual gratification. And there's this sense that I remember having that, you know, when you're getting ready to go out, when you're getting ready to have a night where you're chasing those things, there's this sense that you always have of maybe being on the cusp of something transcendent, right? And I've talked to other people that feel this, that there's, you feel like you're pushing yourself towards something transcendent and mythic, and you never really achieve that, right? And part of what happens when you reach a certain age is that the realization kicks in that you're going to have diminishing returns in your pursuit of that transcendence. And it seems to me that the book is about someone who has that realization maybe later in his life and is either broken or healed by the force of that realization, right? So does all that make sense? Does all that resonate with you guys as legitimate? Do you have any thoughts about it?
Sounds solved to me.
Yeah. Podcast over. I just wanted to say I just wanted to say there is nothing quite like those moments when, by your own or by social measures, you should be on top of the world, but you find yourself despondent, almost kind of contrary to. There's a point in the first half of the book where Jeff is kind of at his highest point, like with Laura and partying in Venice, and suddenly he's like grabbing an acquaintance and telling him that he's terrified, and I know that feeling of kind of getting what you want and then being sad anyway, and realizing that the floor is kind of dropping out from underneath you, and I think in the way that it really only can in those moments when you don't feel like you have a reason for being so disappointed in your situation as you are. And that really resonated with me. That sudden like flare of depression and anxiety in that moment. Cause I am remembering that, right? It's basically like he doesn't end up with Laura in the end, and he's very upset about it. But basically, like, at the point where he has that sort of like mini breakdown, he's kind of flying high. He's got everything that he wanted, right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I was flipping through the book just now trying to find that, and it's a little hard to find anything on a flip through because there aren't really chapters or anything like that. But if I remember right, it's on the boat, isn't it? He and Laura, they do cocaine on a yacht at a yacht party. And at some point he has this sudden drop into terror because he does have everything, because all his desires have been granted, and there's nowhere to go but down, right? And there's not any kind of way to continue building gratification. There's just the fear of loss now.
Yeah. Yeah, he makes his friend promise, or makes his friend tell him that everything's going to be all right. You know, like that nothing bad's going to happen to me, right? Nothing bad can happen to me. And they're all they're drunk and all screwed up. And I want to talk about at some point about the Dyer's craft. Because I only read Zona by Dyer, but he has this ability to just luxuriate in moments where there is no real tension, and somehow make it like really engaging to read. And here we are with these really not very good people, not compelling in like what they're giving to the world around them, you know, just drinking and having like existential crisis. I don't know. I'm derailing, but Hans, you wanted to say, I just want to come back to why it is I enjoyed reading this story at all at some point because of Dyer's obvious craft. But you were going to say more about his breakdown?
Maybe not so much about the breakdown. I just wanted to say that I do feel like we should acknowledge. I mean, I think that the themes of the way that he uses the theme of desire here is, I think, very rooted in Hindu and Buddhist ideas, right? The Buddha. Yeah.
Definitely.
And we were talking when we did the podcast on When we did the podcast on Death of Vishnu last week, we were talking a little bit about the relationship between Hindu and Buddhist ideas, and I'm not at all educated in those, and I'm reluctant to bring them up because I'll probably say something ignorant or inappropriate or vastly oversimplify, right? But my understanding is that Buddhism arose in a Hindu context, and a lot of their ideas about life, death, and the values of living and being are very similar. And the ideas of desire and transcendence as they operate here seemed to me, to my limited understanding, to be very Buddhist, right? Because my understanding of the idea of reincarnation essentially is, you know, you live, you die, the quality to which you lead your life determines how you come back, determines what you come back as, what station you come back in. But the point of all that is to achieve, the point of all that is to let go, basically, right? The point of the cycle of life and death is to experience and sate yourself on worldly pleasure, right? And the Buddha began by being, the Buddha went through a phase of consumption, right? Went through a phase of sex and, you know, the equivalent for his time of what Jeff does in Venice, really. And at some point understood the hollowness of that by experiencing it. And so, you know, one of the points of experiencing the cycle of life and death is to not to avoid those pleasures by denying yourself, but to sate yourself on those pleasures so you understand that they are hollow, so that you can achieve another stage of enlightenment. So the experience that Jeff has of sating himself on pleasure in Venice, understanding the hollowness of it, understanding the futility of it, and then reaching a state of renunciation is, I feel like I should acknowledge, I think that maybe if I understood Hindu and Buddhist ideas and spirituality better, I might recognize that with more texture than I do, but it is, to my limited understanding, very rooted in that, and I should say that just in case anybody listens to this that knows that stuff better than I do. And also, I think, because it gives more of a sense for, it gives a little bit of a context, I think, for what's happening thematically between the two sections, for how the two sections are tied in terms of the evolution of the character.
How does our enjoyment or appreciation of this book shift with our, is this book trying to convince us of, or like, is there, you were suggesting ambiguity, Hans, and how you described it, that we were maybe not seeing someone transcend the cycle of reincarnation and the just general misery of existence, you know, when Jeff kind of stops wearing clothes and gets real thin and starts sort of jabbering nonsense at tourists and just sort of retreats from people. And I guess there's a two-part question. Do you think that it is in the text that we're supposed to be kind of unsure, or, and if so, then what is Dyer doing with that sort of ambiguous ending? And then if we're kind of instead meant to kind of come away with some sort of appreciation of Jeff's journey to this place where he's in a maybe a better place than he was in the first half of the book, are we intended to be convinced by that? Are we intended Look, do you get what I'm asking?
I do.
I'm not sure I'm describing.
I think I do. Yeah. So your question is, I mean, there are a few questions to unpack in your question, right? If I'm understanding, one of those is, are we to applaud Jeff's change or are we to shudder at it, right? And if we're to shudder at it, what does that mean? What does it mean that enlightenment turns him into, by our standards, by any reasonable, you know, by the standards of most people, a very unhealthy person, physically and psychologically unhealthy and near death, right? There's a way that I thought about this. So when I read this, it was the third time when I read it to prepare for this podcast. And the first time that I read it, I don't think I knew what to think about anything. And the second time that I read it, the interpretation that I had then was that there's something very perhaps nihilistic about it, right? That the novel suggests that there are two ways of being. One of those is the unexamined pursuit of pleasure, and that perhaps many things that we might want, even though this isn't necessarily drawn out, right? A lot of the things that might be less classically decadent might still ultimately lead to that same hollowness, right? If he were trying to, you know, if he were a driven artist, right, that wouldn't necessarily ultimately make him any more satisfied than being a driven partier. But that the alternative to that is death, madness, right? That to be alive and engaged with the world is to want futilely, endlessly, right? And to let go of that is essentially to disintegrate, which is what he does. So in the first half of the book, he's unenlightened, but human. In the second half, he is enlightened and ultimately sort of inhuman. And there's a line near the end of the first section where he's talking about how all the drugs and drinking he's done over the years are gradually burning out his brain. And he says, forgetting everyone's names was embarrassing, but apart from that, being stupid was fine, like a premonition of enlightenment. So there's a suggestion there that enlightenment is, in fact, that the oblivion of enlightenment is maybe not so different from the oblivion of idiocy, right? But then reading it a third time, I thought a bit about, this is a very minor detail, and it might be that I'm ascribing much too much to a minor detail, right? But there's a section where he makes a reference to seeing someone who looks like, I think it's Andre Agassi. I may be saying that totally wrong. The tennis player, Andre Agassi.
Andre Agassi.
Agassi. He makes a reference to seeing someone who looks like the tennis player, Andre Agassi. And he says, yeah, not Andre Agassi as he is now, but Andre Agassi as he looked then. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because it suggests, and this seems very minor maybe, but it suggests that the person who is narrating this now has come back from this state and has a few years of remove and is back to being in a place where he watches tennis, right? Because one thing that the character in the second half talks about is the importance to him of watching tennis, right? So it's that little detail, as small as it might be, suggested to me that this is not a terminal state, right? And if you go back again, I know I'm talking a lot about Buddhism for a book that's very explicitly interested in Hindu mythology, but the Buddha had a phase of decadence, and then the Buddha had a phase of asceticism, right, where he did nothing, he ate nothing, he wasted away to almost nothing. And from those two things came to the realization of the importance of a middle way, right? Which suggests to me that maybe rather than being, rather than the end of this book representing a terminal state in some sort of decay into oblivion / enlightenment, perhaps actually there's a very subtle implication that Jeff does eventually achieve a middle way that is not so much suggested, right? That there's kind of an imagined third portion of the book that represents some sense of wholeness and enlightenment that he comes out with after he finally kind of hits bottom at the end of this book when he has the hallucination of being tucked into a kangaroo's pouch with the god Ganuna.
There's another part that hinted at a kind of future narrator looking back at this period. At least for me in the moment, there was something very specific in the language that he used when talking about the monkey who takes his shades. And he introduces that section, and I listened to an audiobook copy, so I don't have text in front of me to read, but he introduces that section and he says, like, there's one thing that I would recount from this period. It would be the situation with the monkey. He says something like that. And I wondered if this period,
he says,
oh, you're looking at it.
I have it in my memory. He says, if there's one moment from this period that I wish I had on video, it's the encounter with the monkey.
Yeah, and this period, what does this period mean? Something similar occurred to me to what you're describing, Hans. Does this period include, you know, the ending of the book and then, you know, this whole time in Varanasi? Or is it just leading up to the, you know, kind of dissolution of self where we end? But even if it, But you know, it feels like, you know, like at some point he has to be telling the story, and he's telling it pretty cogently. So maybe, I don't know, maybe that's rat eating its own tail analysis, though. Like, at some point he has to tell the story, so he must have come back. But, you know, maybe not.
I think that's valid. I mean, I think that you could very easily tell this in present tense, right? But he tells it in past tense.
Yes.
And in fact, for the most part, the second half of the book, it's very focused in time. It's very immediate. It's very narrow in its chronological band. There's no logistical reason, for the most part, that you couldn't put it in present tense. And I think that Dyer is aware enough and sharp enough. Honestly, I think that if he had wanted to more strongly suggest that Jeff is falling off some kind of irrecoverable precipice, I think that he would have probably done that. And I think, again, like, putting it in present tense rather than past would be a good way to do that.
So that strongly implies that we're supposed to celebrate this, like,
that
epiphany,
it is in fact, yeah, that, right? It is in fact a necessary step in a journey and to be applauded as such. I want to, if neither of you have anything to add to that thematically. And Patrick, you didn't talk much about your thoughts about whether the development at the end of the book is positive, negative, neutral. So I don't want to cut this off if you have thoughts about that. But I do think, Chris, that your point.
No.
So you don't
What's
have
Chris's
thoughts?
Point?
Well, Chris, you had mentioned craft and the role of craft, and I thought that might be worth coming back to. So I was going to try to transition to that if we didn't have anything else to say about.
No, we can. I'm not, I don't, like, everything you've said makes sense to me, and the reading, I think you guys have articulated the reading that I have of it. So You know, I don't really have anything necessary to add. I mean, I had a thought that I would like to explore, but it's kind of more metatextual. So let's go on to what you wanted to talk about.
Yeah. So I was going to bring it back to craft on a couple different fronts. And one of those just had to do with, you know, with the Venice section in particular, I think that you could, if you were to describe what happens in the Venice section or a reasonable thematic reading of the Venice section, it might seem kind of dreadful, right? If it's a guy parties a bunch and has sex and does drugs and then realizes that actually partying and having sex and doing drugs are maybe hollow and won't satisfy him long term. But it's not totally clear if he realizes that, and he might be struggling with that realization. That doesn't sound like an interesting thing to read, right? And I think that there's, I mean, I liked it, you know. I found it terribly entertaining. I adore this book, actually. But
yeah, it's fucking hilarious.
But I think that it's a testament. I think that it's a testament pretty much entirely to craft that it is enjoyable in spite of the point that I just made about what it would sound like if you were to try to describe it to somebody. I was just wondering, is there anything going on there that we can articulate or pin down in terms of what's being done craft-wise beyond just Dyer is very witty and clever? Or is it pretty much just that?
Well, I think it comes down to the scene where Jeff sticks his hand between Laura's legs and Laura pisses on his hand. I think that's a key scene that we need to talk about.
Okay. How so?
I don't know. You just wanted to
throw that one in there.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was hilarious. I mean, craft wise, the reason I liked this book is I just thought it was hilarious. Like, there's a bunch of hilarious scenes. Like, he gets stoned with that old woman. He likes Laura pissing on his hand. I mean, it's funny. I don't know. I suppose the question craft-wise is how does it being funny lend itself to, like, all these themes that you guys have been talking about? Or if, like, it's being funny is just the, like, accelerant, so, like, the necessary accelerant to keep people reading? So that, like, we'll delve deeper into these, you know, these possible themes of, like, steps toward enlightenment or steps, you know, through the different stages of life.
And that's a reasonable point if that's all it is, right? I think that that's, well, I don't think that that should be underrated. I think that's a very, even though it's very simple to state that process, even though it's very simple to say, well, it's funny, right, and the funniness makes it easier to take a novel about becoming enlightened than that.
Right.
That's a very easy to say, very difficult to actually pull off. Although from what I read about Dyer, it doesn't seem like he tries that hard, right? I mean, it seems like in his case, it's mostly just a matter of natural aptitude. But it's very impressive whether it's craft or talent. And I'm sure that, you know, he's probably overestimating the role of craft, underestimating that of talent, just for modesty's sake. But
is this, I mean, like, it seems as though we're kind of invited to think that this is kind of reflective of his life, right? I mean, like, he's a British writer who, from what I can tell, did a lot of commission work for different media outlets and is a thin, tall, thin, British writer, you know, who's of the right age and to be doing cocaine in Venice at the height of like this really hedonistic sort of art scene. But like, does that change? Because you, Patrick, you asked what this is. And like, are we like, does that complicate things at all? Like if, this were written by God, Zadie Smith or somebody, you know, like would that change the book somehow other than making it awful? Sorry. Well, don't need to throw shade at Zadie Smith.
Oh, you don't like Zadie Smith? I don't know if I've ever read Zadie Smith. But, like, my question about what it is didn't actually have anything to do with the fact that, like, the Jeff character might be some form of Jeff Dyer, the author. My question about whether or not what it is more about the fact that, like, plot wise the two narratives aren't connected, other than the fact that they're probably about the same character. That's the only like real plot connection that I can see. So I don't know, maybe ultimately it's a, like, wondering what it is about. There are maybe both are two good reasons to think that it may not be best called a novel. I don't know. Like, maybe, like, you know, we still called Homeland Elegies a novel, even though it seemed to be based on, you know, the author's real life experiences. So I don't know.
Well, and I think that Homeland Elegies, one point that we made with Homeland Elegies was that it uses the appearance of factual basis in a very strategic way, right? That with Homeland Elegies, mm-hmm. it kind of wields that as a canon almost. And right. That it, to some extent, it, I don't know if I'd say Homeland Elegies gets away with things by appearing to be rooted in fact, but the appearance of fact in Homeland Elegies is something that allows it to disregard some conventions of novel writing in ways that are either slipshod or artful, depending on how generous you want to be toward it. And I don't know if I'm not sure if with Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi, I'm not sure if there are ways certainly in which it disregards conventional novelistic cues and expectations, but I don't know that disregard is rooted particularly in the fact that the author and the protagonist share a first name, right? I think if the protagonist were...
Right.
Like if we knew that Jeff Dyer were fat, the real life Jeff Dyer were fat, and if the character in the book was named Nigel, I don't think he would have any less authority to do what it does in terms of defying novelistic expectation. I mean, I think it gets that authority more from, again, being very entertaining right. at a page level and from having right, a certain right, right. amount of thematic cohesion, right? The trick here is that you expect plot cohesion and instead you get thematic cohesion. And you take that as a reader because it's very, very entertaining page by page.
Right, right. And yeah, I definitely agree. Like, this is not using, like, connections between the author and the character in the same way that Homeland Elegies is. And like you say, like, I think Homeland Elegies is definitely using those connections in a strategic way. And this, it seems like you could assume that those connections don't exist and nothing thematic changes about the book.
Yeah, my sense, once again, I mean, going back right. to interviews I've read with Dyer, is basically that, I mean, he said in interviews that he wrote the character so similar to himself, again, basically just out of laziness. So,
Right. Sure, sure, sure.
Not that, like, you know, that's, again, author intention's not the be-all, end-all, but it does seem to have been the case. I think it seems plausibly true here, right? He understands what his abilities are, and he doesn't push himself where he doesn't have ability. And inventing people is not apparently one of his strong suits.
I think he mentions his laziness in Zona, too. It's been years since I've read that, but like, as a writer, I feel certain that I went into this book with an impression of Jeff Dyer as someone who's just insanely gifted on a sentence level, who can just make you read about nothing or very little of like dramatic substance and still feel really thoroughly engaged.
Yeah, how do you do that?
I don't know. I don't understand it.
Like, that seems like a really good skill that I wish I had.
Well, Zona, Patrick, I think we mentioned it last time, but it is a book about him watching a movie.
The movie Stalker?
The movie Stalker, yeah.
Right, by
Tarkovsky.
What's that guy? He did
Andrei
Tarkovsky.
Yeah, he did it. He did a version of Solaris, too.
He did the original of Solaris. He did the original. Yeah. And then Soderbergh remade it.
Right.
Well, I guess the original is the novel, but...
Actually, the original is the novel, and I do love the novel. But I feel like there's actually not... I feel like there are three film versions of Solaris, and Tartakovsky's is the second.
Maybe so. I've never heard of the third one, but I'd have to...
is a different person.
Yeah, I don't know. But either way, like, none of the films actually capture the novel. Like, Tartakovsky, like, has his own agenda with Solaris. Like, he's doing his own fucking thing. He's not doing Solaris. He's doing what he wants, which is fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, the film is, like, fucking amazing, actually.
Do you like the...
Like, I remember... Anyway.
Do you like the Soderbergh version?
Yeah, I like the Soderbergh version. I like both versions, but like, if I were to watch them, I would think this is not I'm not getting like the Lem novel. Like, they are all three of them are interested in very different things. Like, the Lem novel is interested in satirizing science. In what our certainties are and whatnot. And the other two films are more about, like, you know, identity and like what, like, how at the bottom, like, identity is this fluid, weird ass thing. And that's not really in Lem's novel at all, I don't think.
Yeah, and the Soderbergh is much more interested in sentiment, as I recall. I don't mean that in a demeaning way, right? But it finds and focuses on a level of emotion in the story that Lim and Tarkovsky.
Right.
It's just not their kind of thing, you know. So.
I am fond
of all three, but.
Right.
Similarly, if you watch Stalker, you should read the book that inspired it.
Stalker.
Yeah, another Roadside Picnic.
Oh, by the...
Or Roadside Picnic.
The Russian dudes.
Like, it's great.
The Russian it's brothers. Very,
yes, the Russian brothers. God, I don't remember their names. It is also, like, Stalker is very, very... Oh, thank you. Very different from the movie. The movie is very different from the book.
Right.
And they're both excellent. The book is also great. So
cool. I actually have thought about reading a different novel by the Russian brothers. I think it was Doomed City. Yeah, the Strugatsky brothers. Like, I think I have Doomed City on my wish list. But I might do Roadside Picnic. Just because, you know, it's always good to have something good to read.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Every time I read this, every time I read Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi, I think to myself, man, I really ought to read a bunch more Jeff Dyer. Because, I mean, I like I said before, I really liked this book. I loved Zona. And then, you know, I start looking through his books, and none of them sound appealing at all. And it's like, even though I understand that, like, this book doesn't really sound appealing if you just read an overview of it, and that the whole point of Jeff Dyer is his approach to the topic and not the topic itself, I still can't. Right. I've still never been able to quite bring myself to get around to, like, reading his book about spending a day on an aircraft carrier, right? Or reading his book about D.H. Lawrence, who I've never actually read, or you know, reading his book about yoga, right? Like, he has, even though I understand that with him it's more about the style and the approach and less about the topic, there's still sort of this wall where, like, none of it sounds, I can't pick one because none of it sounds appealing.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe this will be a spur to try to get over that.
No, I had
a kind of a thought that something occurred to me while I was reading this, where I really did enjoy this book a lot, and I came away, you know, I'm kind of turning into more, I don't know, spiritually curious and stuff like that, and I came away very thoroughly convinced of the characters, like, I don't know, whatever was happening for him, to him, being good for him at the very least. Mm. Better, he was in a better place in the second half for himself than he was in the first. And I do kind of wonder if, like, just an aside, if this book changes, if he's like this really important sort of like brain surgeon who's saving people every day, and then he decides to basically retreat from society and you know, become an ascetic in Varanasi. It's not like he was doing anything good for society in the first half of the book. Like, him retreating from society is no different from him being extraordinarily selfish and self-centered and self-obsessed in the first, in terms of, like, his relative worth to the world around him. And I just wonder if, like, the book changes if someone were, you know, equally derided by vanity and by wanting things and not getting them, and, you know, being miserable because we're all miserable, except for the fact that he's, like, inventing a cure for AIDS, you know. And then it's like, no, I'm going to go to Varanasi and just sort of get rid of all earthly concerns and
listen to my neighbors.
So anyway,
sex.
Just a thought. Yeah, exactly. Stick it in and wiggle it around. I forgot what I was going to say. I don't remember. I lost it. Sorry.
I think there has to be a difference, ultimately. Although it's hard for me to articulate why there has to be a difference. I mean, maybe part of the dislocation that leads to this experience is the fact that he doesn't really care about anything. He doesn't value anything that he does, right? I think like he says very explicitly at one point, he has the realization that he just doesn't care that much about anything. He sees a couple musicians and how much they're engaged with their music. And he thinks, there's nothing in my life I've ever cared about that much. And I don't know if having that kind of care for something like playing music or brain surgery, I don't know necessarily if that's an impediment to enlightenment or an aid to enlightenment or irrelevant to the question of enlightenment, but I think that he needs to be rootless and uncaring to experience the transition that he does.
So that makes sense. And I remember what I was going to say. Thank you for stepping in, Hans. You're a sweetheart. You've talked about it before, Hans. I think that you and David Krause talked about how we're not in an era of rock stars anymore. And for some reason, it occurred to me while reading this book that I enjoyed very much that I think, like, though I enjoyed it very much, it doesn't seem to be a work. It doesn't seem to be concerned about being a work that is like a transcendental signifier or like a something that will, you know, I don't know if this book is something that exists 50 years from now, like in the canon in any way, even though it's great, like even though it's really good, I don't know what lasts, what persists from this book in time. And I, it just occurred to me that like, are we, it's a really big question, but are we in a time where like the novels that come out are not, the stories that we tell, that we market, are not so, they're not rock stars. They don't have the same aura about them. They don't accumulate study and attention in the same way over time.
Meaning that it can sometimes, I guess, is full.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Maybe. I think either the canon is full or the things that will join the canon, we're very unhappy to, like, if we were to find out, I think if we were to find out in 50 years what it is that has come out in our lifetimes that will have joined the canon, I have a feeling we'll probably be kind of unhappy to hear what it is, you know? Like,
give me
an
example.
Well, like, I don't ever want to hear the fucking words Harry Potter again. And in 50 years, people will probably be studying Harry Potter at university. Just a guess,
I don't know.
Right?
I
don't know. Maybe not.
Like,
maybe,
I see what you're saying.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe I'm too casually.
Nominate what you would want. Nominate what you would want to see in the canon from like the last 20 years.
What I would want to see in the canon from the last 20 years. I guess that gets into the question of like, what is the point of the canon, right? Is the point of the canon?
Yeah.
Which I feel like maybe we should just have a whole separate podcast about. I mean, the first thing I would say is that I don't think that I am personally knowledgeable enough that I'm confident nominating what would go into the canon, because I don't think I read enough of what comes out, right? I do think that if you think about what goes into the canon, like I'm just trying to think of the novels that were canonical when I went through grad school, right? And a lot of those were things that reprocessed a past event for the current era, right? They were things, and maybe not the era that I read them in, but for the era, you know, if you think about like Beloved, right? Beloved is mm-hmm. a novel that reapproaches American history relative to the values of the early 90s. And as it happens, the values of the early 90s around how we regard slavery were close enough to the values of the 2010s that we were still reading Beloved, right? Gravity's Rainbow, right? That's a novel that reprocesses the experience of World War II relative to the values of the 70s. And, you know, again, the values of the 70s around how to think about war and money, war and money were close enough that that still felt current when I went through it. You know, maybe it wouldn't be now. I don't know. But I guess by that standard, what has come out now that I have read that has reprocessed history for the values of the current age, and also that's really good, right? Like, the first thing that comes to mind actually is Homeland Elegies, right? Like, Homeland Elegies, in terms of the what it how it reprocesses history, in some ways is very similar, right, to something like Gravity's Rainbow or Beloved. But we as a group were much less impressed just with the quality of Homeland Elegies as writing. And I guess maybe, you know, if you're thinking that Harry Potter is not in the canon, why is Harry Potter not in the canon? Maybe just because people will still read it for fun, right? Things that go into the canon have to be things that they're good enough that you have fun reading them, but the general public will not reread them for fun perpetually, right? I don't know.
This reminds me a lot of, I don't know, have either of you guys read Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott?
No, I haven't.
Yeah. It's been a long time.
Well, it's like, Ivanhoe is still around, and people still read it, but, like, it's kind of awful. I read it a few years ago, like, you know, like I was in a British literature kick. So I looked around at some of the different comps lists for literature programs, at, you know, just at different universities. And I wanted to see how many I'd read, you know, I'd read the Austen novels, I'd read the Hardy novels, and a few others. There's still some stuff that I haven't read. Like, I still haven't gotten into Dickens. I've tried. But, you know, like, Ivanhoe is on these lists, but more like it's on these lists for a comparison with, like, here are a lot of good novels, and then there's Ivanhoe, which really blows. That's like the rationale that I kept seeing. And I wonder, I feel like if Harry Potter is around in, you know, I think in 50 years, people are still going to be reading Harry Potter for fun. In 100 years, I'm less certain. Like, I feel like it might stick around because it's like, hey, here's an artifact of the time that we recognize now is it's not that great. You know, it's not extremely well written. It's not extremely deep in values or theme. But, like, let's keep reading it in the same way that we keep reading Ivanhoe. I don't know.
I was going to say the because what made me think about this is what you were saying about his other novels, Dyer's other novels, Hans, and thinking about Zona being sort of using that movie, using Stalker as sort of a way to talk about himself, and kind of looking at a lot of these other works of his. I opened his Wikipedia page and thinking about how present I expect Dyer to be, and maybe that's unfair of me to say, you know, a lot of these being vehicles for self-examination. Thinking about, I don't remember his name, the author of My Struggle. I think he's Danish.
Yeah, what is it? Klaus or Naus or, I don't know.
Yeah.
Olgan?
Naugard?
Nav Argard or Klaus Nogard or...
There's really, actually, Patrick, there's nothing more popular than just butchering foreign names for fun.
I don't know. It's
really good for wide listenership. It's like, this is for our...
It's okay if they're Caucasian foreigners. You can get away with it.
Yeah, it's okay. Exactly. Like,
if they're white Europeans.
From Scandinavia. We are white.
We're punching sideways here.
You know. Yeah, exactly.
Well, so
Klaus,
so
Olaf, Hammett, Knut, Ogard.
Oh, let's say. Is that his whole name?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, just thinking, like, is this so? Maybe then, actually, Dyer's work fits into our time.
Geoff Dyer is representative
of. Geoff Dyer is representative of our time because our time is characterized by this self-examination and kind of writing about small, mundane dramas. Because, you know, the Iliad, it is not, and it's not about, you know, the dissolution of a marriage, and it's not about, you know, I mean, I guess not very much of actual significance takes place in Geoff in Venice and Death in Varanasi. And looking at the rest of his work, I don't know if very much seems to be, you know, exhibited as taking place in those either. And I wonder if there's some sort of like alignment between his in our time and like what people write about these days and like what he's really good at, which is kind of like writing about these mundane concerns and the canon, you know, what continues forward, because I don't know. It seems like almost if you were to ask Geoff Dyer, I wonder what he would say, whether he would want his work to kind of continue being read decades from now and be considered significant, because it almost seems to explicitly do the opposite. But
that makes me want to really read his study of D.H. Lawrence, actually, because I think that if you were to read his book on D.H. Lawrence, it might illuminate some of your perspectives on that. My understanding from the little that I know about it is that one of the ideas of it is actually... So, Patrick, when you had us read, what was that theory piece we read a few months ago? Triumph of the Ordinary, something like that? Revolution of the Ordinary.
Oh, the critical and piece?
Revolution
of the Ordinary.
And our sense of Revolution of the Ordinary was, among other things, that it was... a critique of the value of strict critical frames as they're conventionally used in academia. And I think that the Lawrence piece does that as well.
A key idea.
And I think that Dyer's piece on Lawrence actually takes the same... My sense from reading about it is that Dyer's piece on Lawrence takes some of that same approach. And I think that the question of... Inevitably, the question of what is in the canon is tied to the question of what is the value of the canon, which is tied to the question of what is the purpose and approach of literary examination, right? And
right.
So, but yeah, what all this is boiling down to is I think I will actually read Dyer's book on Lawrence just to see if maybe that does address some of his thoughts about whether he... wants to be read in 50 or 100 years, whether he's writing to 50 or 100 years. To be frank, I don't think that he will, if for no other reason than he's not getting a lot of critical... I mean, he gets critical attention now, but like we all went through an MFA program, right? Did any of you ever even hear his name in your MFA program?
No,
I don't think he has
a
lot of...
I never heard of him until 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I don't think that he has a lot of institutional or academic interest, and I don't think that he will, right? Which is what it is, you know. There's Patrick, I don't think you would have read this, but Chris, did you ever read What If We're Wrong by Chuck Klosterman?
No.
So that's if you happen to have some time and free mental space, I might recommend that to both of you, actually. But in particular, I think it's called What If We're Wrong, right? So it's a book of essays about trying to look at your present situation and values with the understanding that some fair percentage of what you think and believe will be broadly considered to be wrong in 50 or 100 years, right? Mm. And that's something that I try to keep in mind, you know, like a certain amount of what I believe is wrong or will be broadly considered to be wrong by the standards of, you know, ethical people in 50 or 100 years. I don't know what it is, you know. If I knew what it was, I could change, right? But I'm wrong about probably a decent number of things. And it bothers people sometimes, you know, like people who regard themselves as moral and enlightened, I tell them that and they seem troubled by it, right? But it's good. It means that there's room left for progress, you know? And anyway, so that's what Klosterman's book is about. I guess it's Klosterman. That's what Klosterman's book is about. But I think maybe the first chapter in the book is about the question of what will be in the literary canon in 50 or 100 years, right? And the point that Klosterman makes is that it will probably be something nobody's talking about now, nobody's reading now for the most part, and it'll probably be something that deals with the experiences of a marginalized group that we do not currently recognize as a marginalized group. Now, can you guys think of a book you know that nobody's reading that deals with the experiences of a marginalized group that is not currently thought of as a marginalized group? Have any of you read a book like that in the last couple of years?
No, not me.
Have any of you published a book like that in the last couple of years?
How would I know if like that
have
last
any, have
part
any of you like have any of you like
marginal...
put out a have any of you put out a book on a small press in the last couple of years that fits this description?
Oh, yeah.
The joke here is I'm trying to hint toward my own book.
Are you
right? The joke here is that I read Klosterman's essay and I thought, oh, Klosterman has just made a very cogent case that I will be, in fact, in the canon in 100 years.
In the canon?
In the canon. That's.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I felt, as you guys know, my literary career is not what I had hoped, but I felt somewhat redeemed by reading Klosterman's essay. Not that I really think I'll be in the canon, but it made me feel a bit less suicidal for doing what I did, you know?
Well, what you did still blows me away for the effort that you put into it, man. And honestly, the book.
Yeah,
the
and
book
I don't,
is,
I don't,
the book
I mean,
is really
I mean,
good.
I don't, I'm not trying to like turn this into blowing smoke up my own ass. It's just that like, this is
shut
the
up.
Main,
take
you,
a compliment,
you, right? But like, this is the you know when I think. About
I mean,
the
yeah,
question
I,
of,
I do think your book is awesome.
When I think about the question of what will be canonical in 50 years, I do think that Klosterman's essay is one of the more interesting takes that I've read on that, and I couldn't help you know, inevitably couldn't help feeling somewhat smug about it. But sorry, go ahead.
Sure.
And I feel like kind of a dick for digging on Jeff Dyer I've only read two of his works and
Geoff Dyer
and saying, you know, he's obviously not ambitious. I do really do feel like he mentioned like a kind of an inherent laziness in his process and his style and in the Zona book and that was kind of what made me think of it. But that being said, he's written far more than I have. He's obviously put the work in and he's done a lot of, you know, really influential work. It just strikes me that like what he writes and it's the same for this Lawrence book. I'm reading the analysis of it. Like the blurb is, you know, welcome to the world of Dyer, gripped by indecision at every turn. He agonizes over where to settle down to write, whether or not he should move in with his almost girlfriend, and even which edition of Lawrence's poems to pack in his rucksack. Like, these all feel like reasons to write about himself, and that's fine. It just is, like, and I love reading it, you know. It just is like, is that, what is that? Maybe that obviously we don't have time. I just, you know, this guy's made a career out of writing about himself, but using different things as a foil. In this case, an entirely different writer. I don't know. I don't know why I'm being combative about it.
All right. Well,
That's Jeffrey Dyer.
That's how we feel about Jeff Dyer. What a lazy fuck. God.
Yeah.
Think what I could do if I had half his talent. Jesus.
Yeah. Piece of shit.
I think maybe that's why I'm mad. Maybe I'm mad because he makes all of this really great. He makes it good to read.
Don't be mad. Just don't be.
You've convinced me, Patrick. I'm not mad at you.
Good.
You did a great job talking him down just then. That was
short, just, sweet. Just don't be mad. There's no reason, you know, 150 years, the human race is gone. Doesn't matter. Like, this question of canon, totally worthless and mute. A moot point. Moot point, people. Sound good?
Yeah. That's a good way to wrap it up. So who's picking next week?
It's Patrick.
It's my pick, and we're going to do Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre.
Awesome.
All right. Cool. We'll read that and reconvene in a couple weeks. Listeners, I hope you have enjoyed. Like, this podcast, like, went somewhere different, I feel like. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. And peace out until next time.